From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with one of Pakistan's most popular novelists, Bapsi Sidhwa. She's also a women's rights activist, challenging the rigidly defined roles of men and women in her country. Also, a talk with filmmaker Tom Kalin. His new film, Swoon, is about the famous Leopold Loeb case from the 1920s and how the killer's homosexuality figured into their crime and their trial. And Dracula. Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie. Maureen Corrigan reviews the classic book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton announced tough new ethics rules for his transition team members today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Warren Christopher, the operational head of Clinton's transition, said the rules were the strongest, toughest ethics guidelines ever put forward for a presidential transition. Any person who works in the transition will have to sign a pledge promising not to lobby the federal agency they have responsibility for the period of the transition and then for 6 months afterwards. They'll also have to promise never to use any non-public information they gather during the transition for private gain. This ban will not eliminate paid lobbyists from the transition process. Many will participate in the cluster groups that are performing agency-by-agency audits for Clinton. But, according to Clinton aides, the new rules send a signal that special interests will not have special influence on the process. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Justice Department has taken steps that could lead to a request for a court-appointed special prosecutor to investigate the government's handling of a case involving illegal bank loans to Iraq. Special Counsel Frederick Lacey told the Associated Press today that he was appointed to study the issue by Attorney General William Barr. Lacey said that Barr had given him until December the 8th to recommend whether a Watergate-style special prosecutor should be appointed to investigate the case. That would give Barr a week to make a decision before the special prosecutor law expires on December 15th. Lacey said he recommended a preliminary inquiry into the matter a week before the election, but neither he nor Barr made the matter public. The United Nations Security Council began what's expected to be a lengthy debate today on the situation in Bosnia. Much of the session is focusing on the strict trade sanctions imposed on the former republics of Yugoslavia last May. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The debate was requested by Muslim countries, which are pressing the Council to lift the arms embargo against Bosnia so the besieged nation can defend itself against Serbian forces. But Western officials have already ruled out lifting the ban, so today's debate focused on other aspects of the sanctions. UN envoy Cyrus Vance said some countries appear to be violating the embargo by selling goods to the republics.
It is common knowledge that transit documents are currently being misused and that embargoed oil is getting through in larger and larger quantities.
On Monday, the Council is to vote on a resolution that would tighten the embargo by encouraging countries to search ships if they're suspected of carrying goods into the republics. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 7 points today to close at 3,233. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The federal judge who tried Manuel Noriega said today that he believes the former Panamanian dictator is a prisoner of war and shouldn't be confined in a prison for civilians. Noriega faces a 40-year sentence on his drug and racketeering convictions last April. His attorneys have argued that he was commander of his country's troops when he was arrested during the 1989 invasion of Panama and thus became a prisoner of war when he surrendered. Judge William Hovler said that he may not have the authority to determine where Noriega will be sent. One Southern California city has recounted the number of homeless people living on its streets. The tally is nearly 5 times higher than the number reported by the U.S. Census Bureau 2 years ago. In Los Angeles, Kitty Feldy reports.
Pasadena City officials knew there were more than 234 street people living within their civic boundaries, the number found by the U.S. Census in 1990. So they conducted a census of their own, using homeless people to help them find those who sleep in the ivy under freeway overpasses or in abandoned buildings. Joe Coletti, co-chair of the Pasadena Housing and Homeless Network, says they found more than 50 people sleeping in a park.
All over, there were people that were sleeping under bushes. There were some people sleeping in the back of, say, one of the park buildings, and almost anywhere they can.
The recount found 1,017 homeless, including 236 women and 203 children. The city will use the new numbers to increase the amount of state and federal funds for homeless services. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Labor Party leaders in Britain said today they have conclusive evidence that Prime Minister John Major knew about arms sales to Iraq in 1989. The Labor Party has tried to embarrass Major's conservative government by suggesting it was too supportive of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein before the Persian Gulf War. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is a women's rights activist from a country where many women see the world from behind a veil. Bapsi Sidhwa has been a social worker in Pakistan and was her country's representative to the Asian Women's Congress in 1975. Sidhwa is also one of Pakistan's most popular novelists and one of the first to be published internationally. Her latest novel, Cracking India, was published last year in the States by Milkweed Editions. This fall, Milkweed reprinted her first novel, The Crow Eaters. Cracking India is set in the late 40s, after England pulled out of India, and the country was divided into predominantly Hindu India and predominantly Muslim Pakistan. Sidhwa was 9 at the time of the partition, and she remembers the atmosphere of violence and betrayal as Muslims, Hindus, Parsis, and Sikhs fought among themselves. As a Parsi, she was part of a minority group. The Parsi religion has under 500,000 followers in the whole world. The novel is semi-autobiographical, told from the perspective of an 8-year-old Parsi girl. Here's a short reading.
There is much disturbing talk. India is going to be broken. Can one break a country? And what happens if they break it where our house is? Or crack it further up on Waris Road? How will I ever get to Godmother's then? I ask Cousin. Rubbish, she says. No one's going to break India. It's not made of glass. I ask Aya. They'll dig a canal, she ventures. This side for Hindustan and this side for Pakistan. If they want two countries, that's what they'll have to do. Crack India with a long canal. Gandhi, Jinnah, Nehru, Mountbatten are names I hear, and I become aware of religious differences. It is sudden. One day, everybody is themselves, and the next day, they are Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, Christian. People shrink, dwindling into symbols. Aya is no longer just my all-encompassing Aya. She's also a token, a Hindu.
Were you frightened when the country was partitioned?
As a child, I have memories of chants, of mobs chanting in the distance, which were very threatening sounds. I felt they threatened the people I held dear. And I saw fires. It wasn't like a fire display to me. It really was threatening. It was like blood was splashed in the sky. And, of course, all the time, there was talk around me of what was happening to our friends and neighbors, who were at that time Hindu and Sikh, who were leaving, and new refugees arriving. And I saw dead bodies on my Waris Road where I lived.
That's pretty terrifying.
As a child, yes, these sounds more than anything else terrified me.
In your novel, Cracking India, Aya, who is the nursemaid of the main character, the woman who cares for the child, she is kind of destroyed at the end by Muslims because she is a Hindu in Muslim Pakistan. Did you know people who were in that position, people who were close to you?
Not people who were close to me, but I grew up with stories about what happened to so-and-so's sister, mother, daughter, brother, father. Now, these were accounts recited by Muslim refugees because I was in Lahore. What did happen, one of the most terrible aspects of the partition was that hundreds of thousands of women were kidnapped, Hindu women and Sikh women by Muslims and Muslim women by Hindus and Sikhs. It's sort of very true of our part of the world that when you have to celebrate a victory, the victors do so on the body of a woman. And when you want to get rid of the feeling of humiliation at a defeat, there again you humiliate your enemy's women by raping them, etc. So the women were the major targets when it came to power play, humiliation, and celebration in this part of the world. So it was Hindu, Muslim, Sikh women, all of who suffered.
When you say they were kidnapped, where were they taken?
They were kidnapped by individuals, taken into their homes, raped, and then sold for 10 rupees each, 20 rupees each, which is less than a dollar, you know. People would be shouting in the streets, apparently, that zanana for sale, zana for sale. You know that women are being sold, and that's the price, 10 rupees for a woman.
When you became a woman, did you meet women who had been kidnapped and sold years before?
I may have met them, but, you know, this is something, it's considered so dishonorable and so defiling that women would not openly talk about it. Other women would whisper about it. And as a child, I would just catch innuendos and whispers about various women. Where I was living, right next door to me, was a camp for recovered women. These were the women who were kidnapped and then recovered after the partition from various places and brought to these camps. And we as children used to go onto our roof and peek into this camp and look at these very despondent, very poor sort of looking women who didn't talk much. I mean, now with my adult's imagination, I can understand what happened to them. But as a child, I couldn't grasp it. And the sad thing was that a lot of these women were not accepted back by their families because women are supposed to embody honor. You know, they're vessels for honor. And they had been dishonored, so the families didn't want them back into their households. And they were left to fend, you know, by a little training in embroidery and to eke out their lives like that.
You were married at the age of 19. You had three children. You've described yourself as having been an upper-middle-class housewife. Your husband was a businessman. How did you start becoming involved with women's rights?
This is very strange, actually. I read this book, The Female Eunuch, by Germaine Greer. This must be when I was about 25, 26. And I just got up the next day, a totally different person, very aggressive, fighting with my husband, having temper tantrums all around, you know, till I decided I shouldn't read books like that. But that gave me an awareness of, well, why was I so submissive and why was I so accepting of taking the secondary place and being so subservient to other people, whether it was my father, mother, or husband. And then I got involved in social work, and gradually my interest in what was happening to women developed, and also my awareness of what was happening to women. I started doing a lot of social work with destitute women's homes, with orphanages, and there I came across instances which really sort of left their stain on me, and I wanted to do something about it.
When you say that you were tired of being subservient to your parents and to your husband, what was the typical middle-class marriage like in Pakistan or at the time? When you talk about subservience, what do you mean?
Well, you know, you are always waiting for your husband. You're more or less a public relations officer to your husband, entertaining for him all the time, taking phone calls. If you go out in a car, you're the one who's waiting endlessly for him to do his work and come in. And you take everything in your stride. You're told this evening so many people are coming, or this day so-and-so is coming, or keep the house ready, we're expecting so many visitors, or at the drop of the hat, let's travel. I mean, you totally sort of sublimate your life for your husband's existence, before that for your parents' existence. These are very little things, and they're not very demanding, but in the end they accumulate and make for a great demand on one's time.
When you started working with destitute women, did you start becoming aware of the class differences and how women were treated in your country?
Yes, the class difference is there enormously. Among the very poor, The women don't observe the veil, and they work in the fields with the men, except, of course, the village leader's wife. She would observe parda. And her work is not really accounted for in terms of cash. You know, it's free labor. And then when they enter the middle class, interestingly enough, at this point, the woman says, okay, now I'm better off, so I'll go in behind the veil. I'll wear a veil. So it is a status symbol that now my wife does not need to work. We are better off. Then as you get to the much richer classes, then it is the women are, they don't observe the veil, except if they're in very narrow-minded villages, if their husbands happen to be in the mountain villages, you know, sardars or lords out there. And these women have more or less the freedom of a wife in America, perhaps. So the class does make a great difference. And then when I was working in the destitute women's homes, that's when I became aware what had happened. And it's a strange thing that in Pakistan, men outnumber the women. And in these destitute women's, in the home I was working, there were a lot of women with children. By 19, a woman has produced perhaps 4 children. And if there were 25 women in the home, there would be about 300 men wanting to marry them. And once or twice I realized that perhaps there was something wrong going on, because I saw a dwarf and a very sort of cruel-looking man getting married to a very beautiful young woman of 19. And after that, my friends and I decided that we would interview each of the bridegrooms before something like that happened. And we would interview the bridegrooms to find out what they wanted to marry for. Most of them said, oh, you know, we have so many chickens, we have so many goats, we have so many sacks of wheat, and we have nobody to look after it because my wife died. And then we'd say, but you don't want a wife, you just want a free servant. And if a man showed some inclination to romance, that, look, I've had nobody to arrange my marriage because I've been busy for this reason or that reason, and I would like to get married and have a home of my own, then we would introduce the woman, or at least let them have a look at each other and arrange a marriage between them.
Did you ever wear the veil yourself?
Just as a teenager once, to see what it felt like, I borrowed the veil of one of my friend's mothers, and I walked on the street. It was a sort of an adventure.
So how did it feel?
Well, you know, it's a black thing, and you wear it from top to bottom. You wear it like a skull cap over the head, and it flows right down to your feet. And you feel a little cramped, and it's mysterious because there's netting in front, and you look out through that. The world does seem a little hazier. Your movements are constricted. It certainly, I think, shifts you into a different dimension, into a different world, a more cramped world, constricted world.
Do you see religion as an anti-feminist force in Pakistan?
Not the religion itself, but the way it is practiced and the way the mullahs and particularly the fundamentalists interpret it. Sometimes I feel they use religion as something with which to browbeat women and make them more subservient. God knows they're subservient enough, and still they're not satisfied. And they certainly use religion to do so. But a lot of Pakistani women feel they ought to interpret religion according to their lights, and the Quran according to their lights, and they feel they'd come up with a different interpretation.
My guest is Pakistani novelist Bapsi Sidhwa. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Pakistani novelist and women's rights activist Bapsi Sidhwa is my guest. You've explained how you went from being a middle-class homemaker to being a women's rights advocate. How did you become a writer? How did you start writing?
I came across it very accidentally. I'd never written before. And when I was about 28, 29, I visited a remote part of Pakistan in the Karakoram Mountains, which is under total tribal jurisdiction, and the tribes there are so locked into the mountains that they really live in the Stone Age still. They literally live in caves. And I heard the story of a young girl who had been married there and had run away from her husband. And these people think a runaway, if a wife runs away, it's an intolerable insult to the husband. And the whole clan was out hunting her, and eventually these infallible hunters, and they found her near the Indus River just before she could be rescued, and they severed her head from her body. When I heard the story in this very beautifully spectacular country in the northern areas, when I came back to Pakistan, I wanted to tell the story of this girl because it did reflect the lives of quite a few women in a way. And I did want to describe the beauty of the scenes I had seen and the tribals. I mean, they were a very romantic people in a way. And I sat down to write what I thought was a short story. And before I knew it, it was turning into a novel, and it became my first novel, which was called The Bride and now is known as The Pakistani Bride.
You live part of the time in Pakistan and part of the time in the United States.
Yes, lately I've been doing that.
Is it hard to get your work known outside of your country? I know, for instance, your new novel, Cracking India, was first published in England, or at least it was published in England before it was published in the States. Uh-huh. Is it hard to get your work known internationally?
Oh, very hard. If you're living in Pakistan and you write in English, I think I'm the very first to be published abroad, or maybe among the very few. I'd written both the novels, The Pakistani Bride and The Crow Eaters. And although they were accepted by Curtis Brown in America, they were at that time agents, the poor people showed it around to every publisher for about 3 years. And also they sent it to their agents in Britain. And both the books were getting rejection slips, any amount of rejection slips from both sides of the Atlantic. And it was a heartbreaking process for me. I stopped writing for about 6 years in between. So before I could get published, it had taken about 10 years for me to be published abroad. Before that, I was published in Pakistan. And then I was published in Britain and then in America.
Is there a sense among publishers abroad, well, who cares about Pakistan? Who understands Pakistan? Our readers won't want to know.
Precisely. That's what most of the rejection slips said, that though we love the work, we feel Pakistan is too remote in time and space, and who will be interested in it? Unfortunately, in our very competitive market, we don't feel the book will be monetarily, helpful. It won't make money.
What do you have a large readership in Pakistan, proportionately?
A very large readership. I would be considered in the absolute bestseller bracket. And I've had the honor of being pirated. And they're very peculiar versions of my books floating around. I don't mind because they sell cheap. And they're read, so I'm quite happy.
Are they controversial in your country?
We were expecting The Bride to be controversial, but it wasn't for some reason. And that is why The Crow Eaters was published first, because it was mainly a comedy about the Zoroastrians, which tell you everything about my community as well. But that is the novel which became very controversial. My community took great exception to it. They felt I'd let out secrets that I shouldn't have, and they felt threatened because they were a minority. And it's strange because I'd written it out of great affection. But now that I've received from Pakistan what is a very high civilian award called the Sitara-e Pakistan, my community suddenly accepts me and my writing, You need somebody else to accept you, and then your own community accepts you.
Right, because then you make them look good.
Yeah, maybe. At one point, not so good, and then suddenly good.
What are the things about the status of women that you would still like to see changed in Pakistan?
Oh, my God, a lot of things, most of the things. I would like them, first of all, to get education, to get more control of money, more control of their lives. I certainly would like to see any brother, husband, or father who kills his wife to be just hung. I mean, I'm absolutely for capital punishment when it comes to that. Because brothers and fathers think it is their right, if they feel their sister is flirting or has had a secret affair, even with her fiancé, They feel quite justified in killing her. This is, of course, again, we are talking of a class, the peasant class, the poorer classes. And just every sort of zulm, now I'm trying to think, every sort of bullying tactic is used on women, and women are supposed to accept it. And I think I would like to see a lot changed.
Any impressions of the women's movement in the United States?
Yes, of course, I've experienced it, but it's a totally different breed of feminist movement here. Their priorities are different, and their way of handling issues are different. I think there's this huge cultural difference which makes us to react to different things in different ways.
What do you see as the main difference between how the American women's movement handles issues as compared to what you're used to?
It seems to me that they have probably resolved some issues and their priorities have shifted to things which, at this point, because our problems are so enormous, seem to us a little trivial. And we want to be fighting for things where women are in constant physical danger, physically being kidnapped from many parts of the countries to be used in prostitution, and the society turns a blind eye towards it. Whereas some of the issues like, I don't want to really name them because I don't know in what context they fit into the American woman's consciousness. But I know there are some serious problems women face here, and they have to keep struggling against it too.
Kidnapping is still an issue in Pakistan?
Yes, because not only kidnapping, but in the northern areas, the races are very white, pale-colored, and they're extremely poor. So people buy girls there, and they put them into prostitution or, you know, all sorts of slavery and things like that. So that is the form of kidnapping. There are other forms of kidnapping, too. I mean, women, for some reason, because of the segregation in the society or whatever the factor, they are, in a way, a desirable commodity. It's the opposite of India, where a woman pays a dowry to get married. In Pakistan, the husband pays the bride's father, this is in the northern areas of Pakistan, to get a bride. So a woman is like a commodity. She's worth money. So women are kidnapped for several reasons.
Are you still married, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Has it been hard to change so much and keep a marriage together?
We've come to a comfortable relationship. Of course, the marriage pattern did change several times, and particularly after we moved to the States. But I think, living in the society we did in Pakistan, naturally a lot of the values of Pakistan had been absorbed, which could not be sustained in America, where the atmosphere for a woman is a lot freer. And I chafed at some of the things. And my husband also changed a lot of his thinking in this different atmosphere. And we have come down to a much more comfortable relationship.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Bapsi Sidhwa's latest novel, Cracking India, and her first novel, The Crow Eaters, are published in the States by Milkweed Editions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1920s, two young intellectuals murdered a 13-year-old boy for the thrill of it. It became known as the Leopold Loeb case and inspired two Hollywood films, Rope and Compulsion. Now it's inspired a new film, Swoon. We'll talk with the film's director, Tom Kalin. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Francis Ford Coppola's new movie, Dracula. And Maureen Corrigan looks at the classic book that inspired it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Bill Clinton's transition team has announced new ethics rules. Director Warren Christopher calls them the toughest regulations ever for presidential transition. Staff members will have to sign a statement promising not to lobby any federal agency they dealt with for 6 months, and they won't be allowed to handle matters that conflict with personal financial interests. Staffers will also be required to fill out financial disclosure forms. FBI Director William Sessions says the Justice Department will not ask for an independent counsel to investigate criminal allegations against him. NPR's Paz Cohen reports.
Just a month ago, word leaked out that the Justice Department's internal watchdog office was trying to determine if FBI Director Sessions had broken the law or violated governmental ethics. The allegations included evasion of taxes in the District of Columbia and use of office telephones to make personal long-distance calls. This afternoon, the FBI announced that Attorney General William Barr has decided not to ask for an independent counsel to investigate the criminal charges. No reason was given for that decision. The FBI said Director Sessions had cooperated with the inquiry and was pleased to have this matter behind him. But a source close to Mr. Sessions told news services that while the Justice Department clearly had decided there were no grounds for criminal charges, it is still investigating whether the FBI director was involved in ethical misconduct. I'm Paz Cohen in Washington.
Less than 48 hours after a ceasefire went into effect in Bosnia, the truce appeared to be breaking down as heavy fighting was reported in several parts of the republic. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
Journalists in Sarajevo reported that infantry battles broke out in several suburbs of the besieged city. Bosnian radio reported that Serbs launched an infantry attack on the Muslim-held town of Olovo in northern Bosnia. In the south of the republic, Bosnian radio said Serbs launched a fierce artillery attack on the Croatian-held town of Konjic. Bosnian Serb leaders accused the government of Croatia of having deployed 70,000 of its army troops in Bosnia. European community monitors said they had reports of the presence of the regular Croatian army in Bosnia. The ceasefire had been signed by the military chiefs of Bosnia's three warring factions, Serbs, Croats, and Muslims, and came as the United Nations Security Council was meeting to debate imposing tighter sanctions and a naval blockade against Serbia. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
A federal judge in Miami says Manuel Noriega is a prisoner of war and should not serve his sentence in a civilian prison. Judge William Hoover admits he may not be able to enforce his opinion. If he can't, Noriega will probably go to a tough federal prison in Marion, Illinois. Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 7 points. This is NPR. President-elect Bill Clinton's science and technology advisor says major changes are needed in U.S. energy policy. Richard Bradshaw said today Mr. Clinton would tackle those issues, but it would take time. Bradshaw said the president-elect believes energy efficiency is a major priority, and he defended Clinton's decision not to name one environmental or energy advisor to his transition team. In Detroit, the Wayne County prosecutor says criminal charges will be filed against some of the police officers allegedly involved in the fatal beating of a black motorist last week. Don Gagne reports.
The seven Detroit police officers who were present when 35-year-old Malice Green was beaten to death have been suspended. Now prosecuting attorney John O'Hare says there's enough evidence to seek criminal charges against at least two of the officers, perhaps by early next week. But he declines to be more specific, saying interviews with witnesses are still underway.
But what I think is so important is that the community understand that the process is working. And we have a criminal justice system that will see that justice is done in this case.
O'Hare's remarks follow complaints by Detroit residents that the prosecutor's office was taking too long in its investigation. Six of the officers present when Green died were white. O'Hare declined to speculate when asked if race was a factor in the beating. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The United Nations says it will send emergency food aid to more than 1 million Iraqis and ethnic Kurds this winter. The UN's World Food Program will launch a four-month relief operation concentrating on Kurdish areas in northern Iraq. Program officials estimate a need for 49,000 tons of food. The FBI said today it's arrested a man in a bomb hoax against United Airlines. The man, Paul Stews of Los Angeles, allegedly faxed a bomb threat to United on Wednesday, saying the plane would blow up unless United paid him $600,000. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1924, two upper-class Jewish intellectuals, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, killed a 13-year-old boy with no apparent motive. They became known as the Thrill Killers. Anti-Semites attributed the crime to Jewishness. Homophobes linked the crime to the killer's homosexuality. The murder became one of the most infamous crimes of the period. The case inspired two films, Alfred Hitchcock's Rope and Compulsion, starring Orson Welles. Now there's a film called Swoon, which takes a new look at the relationship between the two killers and how their lawyer, Clarence Darrow, used their homosexuality in the trial. The film is very stylized, almost experimental, and is shot in black and white. My guest is the writer and director of Swoon, Tom Kalin. This is his first feature film. Kalin is a founding member of Grand Fury, a collective of artists that is part of the AIDS activist group ACT UP. He told me why he made a film about the Leopold and Loeb case.
I suppose the first reason is sort of anecdotal. I grew up in Chicago. I'm the youngest of 13 kids. And 11 kids, a family of 13. And my grandmother, along with my mother, were both alive at the time of the crime. It's incredibly famous still in Chicago. And my grandmother had a bit of, I suppose, a kind of not so unusual interest in true crime stories, because in the 20s and 30s in Chicago, the only sort of glamour that existed regionally, I think, for people was the excitement of bootlegging and the criminal history there. And my mother actually shudders at this crime, I think, still in the way that maybe people in my generation would think of the Manson murders. It had this kind of unbelievably transgressive edge to it.
Well, what impact did it have on you?
I mean, as a kid, I was just obsessed with a lot of stuff around. My father also worked, I should add, in the prison system. Before he died in the mid-70s, he worked for the State of Illinois Parole Department. So I suppose my family has a little bit of a criminal edge to it. I don't know. I saw photographs of them along with a lot of people from the period. I was obsessed with the 20s because it was a time when a lot of social rebellion was going on. Most common people were criminals because they drank alcohol during a time when it was illegal to drink alcohol. So the whole idea of being a criminal or breaking the law, I think, had a different register. Women were voting for the first time, smoking in public. Certain ideas from kind of European modernism or intellectual ideas were being made more common in the States. And so I think it's a real time of social upheaval that was really interesting, and I was obsessed by this crime because they were, they looked like these kind of two Valentino actors, and they were like the most kind of glamorous, outrageous behavior around such a kind of horrific crime. There seemed to be a real paradox, something really interesting to me there. I mean, during the time, as much as people in Chicago were outraged, young girls were also like sending love notes to Richard Loeb saying, if you don't get out, I'd like to have a date with you or whatever.
This case is often cited for stirring up anti-Semitism. You use it more to show homophobia.
Yeah, the thing that made it really interesting to me was that it was a case that was used for multiple reasons. It injected class suspicion. People were very suspicious of the fact that they were wealthy, that there was a sexual relationship between the two of them, and that they were Jewish and intellectual. I mean, they were the sort of prototypical cultural elite of their day, if you will. It's no accident that the case was really taken up in the 1950s during the McCarthy era, so that the book Compulsion and the movie are kind of imbued with this suspicion of the fact that they were Jewish, intellectual, homosexual, and wealthy. So the film really wants to talk about all of those elements, although I think in the interest of sort of taking what was the most suppressed, it really deals a lot with the kind of suppress testimony around their sexual relationship.
Clarence Darrow was the defense attorney. How did he use their homosexuality in his case?
Well, I think Darrow's really, you know, was incredibly ahead of his time, very forward-thinking. But the kind of, in my eyes at least, the flaw in his reasoning was that he used the fact that there was a sexual relationship between the two of them to argue that there was a sort of disturbance of personality. They couldn't really claim insanity because you'd have to go in front of a jury. You wanted to avoid that and just go in front of a judge. But the whole crux of the argument was that the relationship constituted a certain kind of temporary insanity or a kind of madness. And I think that was the real bone that I wanted to pick with his argument in a certain way, because I feel like that, you know, puts at the kind of their sexual identity becomes the source of this crime instead of it being about what I think it is about, which is about a kind of obsessive desire, and in a certain way very akin or very parallel to the kind of classic film noir scenario of one person being in love or obsessed with somebody who has a kind of criminal urge or a kind of sociopathic edge to them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Kalin, the writer and director of the new movie Swoon, which is based on the Leopold and Loeb murder. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Kalin. He wrote and directed the new movie, Swoon. The film is very stylized, the way you've made it. It's shot in black and white. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about the visual language that you've used to tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, it refers to everything ranging from silent film or sort of melodrama from the 30s or 40s to prison docudramas to even Gasp. One of the big sort of attacks on the film is that it resembles a Calvin Klein commercial. And I think there's a reason to that. I mean, Calvin Klein's, Bruce Weber's photographs refer back to people like Herbert List or Edward Weston or other photographers and filmmakers from the 20s and 30s. So there is a way that the film wants to make a full circle, if you will, in terms of its visual references, embracing the kind of, you know, revisionist aestheticism of a lot of the black and white contemporary ad campaigns that we see on TV or in MTV, and then also refer back to, you know, whole classic film language. Carl Dreyer actually was a really big influence person, made Joan of Arc, among mm-hmm. other films. And so, and also then sort of, you know, B-movies like Gun Crazy or prison dramas. And I think working in black and white really helped us to refer to a lot of things at the same time.
What kind of erotic atmosphere did you want the movie to have with the obsession with crime and the obsession for each other?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the biggest points in the film is that in the 20s, it would be impossible to have a quote-unquote gay identity as we constitute it now. And even it's a stretch to say homosexual. I mean, the preferred term was invert or pervert. So the relationship between the two of them is very much carries along the lines of the original relationship. I think it was very much suppressed and was more about the idea of erotics in the sense of a kind of classic 30s or 40s, even Betty Davis film, where people who are clothed are exchanging glances, smoking cigarettes, etc. It has a very much idea of erotic atmosphere, tension, not so much around, I mean, I don't think their sexual relationship was actually very developed, if you will. I think they were, because they were 18 and 19 years old and both expected to go and marry and raise families and such, there wasn't this great sense of a kind of, they weren't out. They weren't, you know, gay in any sense that we consider it now. So it was much more about the tension that was underneath the relationship, because there was something very transgressive about being so obsessed with each other.
One of the actors has been compared to the young Rock Hudson in the way he looks in your film. And I think that's an apt comparison, and I was wondering if it was intentional.
Well, I mean, I cast the two actors for extremely different types. The actor you're referring to is Dan Schlackett, who plays Richard Loeb. I mean, Richard Loeb is a kind of classic seductive character who everybody, men and women alike, found compelling and was sort of like a fraternity boy, ladies' man type, who had that kind of seductive charm. I think that was accounted for the fact that Nathan Leopold became obsessed with him and they developed this really tangled relationship. The actor who plays Nathan Leopold is much more kind of cerebral character, a bit more removed, and it's through his eyes, actually, we see the case in a certain way about the kind of obsession and being so kind of fixated on somebody that leads you into further and further into this web. that ends up leading to a murder.
Your movie was shot in, I think, under a couple of weeks. And yet, there's such careful lighting and composition. And I can't figure out how you managed to make everything look so carefully designed in the amount of time that it took when you'd really have to rush.
Yeah, we were a case study in controlled hysteria. you know, 14-day shoot. It's what basically all the film was shot in 14 days, and we ran out of money the first time around, so we had an 8-month gap in between, in which, among other things, the hair on one of our actors' head had to grow back out because we'd shaved it during the prison. I mean, it was really about a collaboration with the producer, Christine Vachon, and the woman who shot the film. She actually won the prize at Sundance this year for cinematography, Ellen Kuras. And it had a lot to do with, storyboarding, discussing beforehand, really going into the situation very prepared. And I think actually my background as working in editing had a lot to do with kind of shaping the vision of the film and really thinking of it to be cut as we shot.
So you saw all the edits in your mind before you shot anything?
Yeah, and I wasn't trained traditionally. I didn't go to film school. My background is in painting and video art and photography. And a lot of it had to do with, I mean, it's not conventionally shot insofar as the shot, reverse shot, or having a kind of wide master shot going into coverage. It's all the kind of vocabulary of classic or mainstream film. A lot of the things are very unconventional. I think that's what strikes people. But a certain amount of it had to do with just seeing it very forcefully in my mind and thinking, okay, we'll go this direction and cut it. I suppose it breaks certain laws of, you know, what is coherent cutting. But I think most audiences don't find it at all. I mean, with the language of music video and et cetera, I don't think it's very jarring in terms of being too sophisticated or too complicated.
Can you give us an example of a place where you think you broke some official rule of editing?
The very first scene of the movie is there's a scene where people are reading on a lawn in front of a backdrop, and you constantly see people rolling by. And in order to do it, to have a sense of constant motion, you couldn't possibly do it in one take because people were physically being dragged by on a little rolling platform. So the film is cut up. The lines of dialogue are cut up from different camera perspectives, and all the camera perspectives are flat. In filmmaking, you usually should move the camera so you're at a different angle. And technically, that shouldn't really cut very well or flow very well, but because of the way that it ends up being woven together, it works. And the script supervisor, I remember, was going crazy, going, you can't do this, you can't do this. So
you think there's advantages to not having gone to film school?
Well, I mean, I think that, I think most audiences and people who watch, I mean, people respond to something that's visually inventive, sort of in all ranges, ranging from, a sitcom to if the presidential debates were shot in an interesting way, I suppose people would notice it. I think that having a film that takes on a visual vocabulary that's maybe a little bit more adventurous is more compelling visually to an audience. And for me, it's basically how I think visually. I don't, as much as I've watched a million movies on television or in theaters through my life, I don't really think in terms of the kind of classic composition or just the very standard usage of things like, shooting over someone's shoulder in a conversation and back and forth. It just doesn't lend it. It doesn't have anything really to do with the material. It's more interesting to shoot something that relates to the psychological or visual components of what you're dealing with.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you.
Tom Kalin wrote and directed the new film Swoon. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's happening in Little Rock?
They're talking about standards and ethics down there today, Terry. The ethics standards for the transition team were announced today, and we will be talking also to Pat Choate, who is a critic of the revolving door between government and industry. He wrote a book about it called Agents of Influence. We have a piece on biodiversity, and one of the problems apparently with trying to protect the world's species is it's impossible so far to identify how many there really are. Mayors are talking about what they hope Bill Clinton will do for them, and we're working on a story about cheerleaders who can't get insurance to do stunts.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's Friday the 13th. And once again, Dracula has risen from his grave. Columbia Pictures is calling its new movie Bram Stoker's Dracula after the 1897 novel that inspired the film. But most people probably think of it as Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. Will it prove to be the godfather of all vampire movies? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to find out.
I guess I was a bad person to see this movie with. I couldn't stop snickering. Francis Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula is a movie possessed. It screeches and howls and froths at the mouth. And Coppola uses every trick he can think of, from weird stuttering camera speeds to special effects that place evil eyeballs in the sky. All that, and still the movie never gets much beyond ludicrous. It starts as though it were a grand historical epic. We're back in 1462 with Gary Oldman as a Transylvanian prince whose wife, played by Winona Ryder, commits suicide. This makes him rant and rave and curse God, all of which, for some reason, turns him into a vampire who spends the next few centuries biting necks and longing for the wife he lost. Cut to London, 1897, where we meet a girl named Mina who's a dead ringer for the prince's ex. And what do you know? It just so happens that Mina's husband-to-be, played by the amazingly lame Keanu Reeves, is on his way to Transylvania to do a real estate deal with one Count Dracula. The scenes at the vampire castle are enjoyably hokey, although they owe a lot to the old Todd Browning movie, and not even Gary Oldman in Grandma Moses makeup can hold a flickering candle to Bela Lugosi. But while Reeves stays in Transylvania doing combat with the Count's girlfriends and with his own fake British accent, Dracula himself flaps off to London to seduce Mina. In this scene, he poses as a young Romanian prince and takes her on a date, except halfway through he can't hold back, and poor Mina finds herself fending off the meanest masher she ever met.
Stop this! Stop this! Stop this! God, who are you? I know you.
I have crossed oceans of time.
Unfortunately, there are still oceans of time before the movie is over, too. Except for Oldman and Anthony Hopkins as the vampire killer Van Helsing, the movie doesn't have a single good performance, a single interesting character. It doesn't even have a single scary scene. And yet, at the center of it all is a single very sophisticated perception. That if Count Dracula really loved Mina, he wouldn't just gobble her up body and soul the way he's gobbled up so many others. Like a lover with a terrible disease, he would inform her about what loving him means. That if she succumbs to his charms, she will leave the human world to become part of his monstrous domain. The choice is hers, not his, hers. That's a great twist on the old legend. Great because it takes into account our heightened awareness of the consequences of love in the age of AIDS, and great because it's so supremely romantic. What's not great is the way Coppola has drowned this, his central idea, in so much noisy flummery that the idea itself goes virtually unnoticed. This movie isn't Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's Francis Coppola's frantic attempt to wow the pants off us. You've seen a million vampire movies, he's telling us, but you've never seen makeup like this and lighting like this and trick editing like this. The movie plays like the longest heavy metal video ever made, and that's because Coppola doesn't trust the power of the Dracula myth itself. He's made a film that's rather like its hero. Not lifeless, exactly. Undead.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Well, if you're discouraged by that review, but you're still drawn to the vampire, Maureen Corrigan has a suggestion. Read the book. She says it's even weirder than anything Hollywood or Madison Avenue has been able to dream up.
When Dracula was published in 1897, it received some good reviews, some lukewarm, and one out-and-out rave. "My dear, it is splendid," wrote Charlotte Stoker in a letter to her writer son Bram. "No book since Mrs. Shelley's Frankenstein, or indeed any other book, has come near yours in originality or terror. I have read much, but I have never read a book like it at all." Mama Stoker may have been biased, but she was also right. Dracula has to be one of the oddest, one of the most mentally unstable of the great horror novels. It's obsessed with the terror of change. Maybe because it was written at the tail end of the 19th century, when the conventions that shaped Victorian society were just about to blow up. Stoker's fearful fantasy of what happens when the familiar becomes strange is even played out in his schizoid style of narration. Dracula is an epistolary novel, which ordinarily would mean that it's constructed out of a series of letters, but Stoker went way over the top. Different characters set down their part of the story, not only in letters, but in diaries, through newspaper clippings and medical journals, on tombstones and stenopads, and even on wax cylinder recordings. This constant jotting down of events, sometimes even as they're taking place, makes for moments of suspense in the novel as sharp as Dr. Van Helsing's set of wooden stakes. In one of the most chilling chapters, beautiful, doomed Lucy Westenra finds herself alone in her house in the middle of the night. A wolf has just smashed through her sealed bedroom window, and her mother, just minutes after, dies of shock. Her four maids have been drugged unconscious, and wouldn't you know, the string on her garlic necklace has just broken. Dracula is about to enter the room, and so what's a poor girl to do but write a three-page memo to her fiancé? It ends this way. The air seems full of specks, floating and circling in the draft from the window, and the lights turn blue and dim. What am I to do? God shield me from harm this night. I shall hide this paper in my breast, where they shall find it when they come to lay me out. The exclamation points and terror quotient in that memo are thicker than the swarm of flies in the cell of Dracula's pet madman, Renfield. Dracula the novel sold well when it was first published, but Dracula the vampire didn't become a cultural phenomenon until the novel was adapted for the London stage in 1927. The play was a horror sensation. On one night alone, 29 people fainted. When the Bela Lugosi movie version appeared in 1931, Dracula had sunk his fangs deep into the lifeblood of mass culture. Of course, the novel is still around, but most people now know the story of Dracula through the movie versions. And no matter how terrifying they may be, they can't capture the memo-spewing mania of the novel. So my suggestion for this weekend is to avoid the crush at the Coppola movie, sit down with a good glass of ruby red claret, and read the book, if you dare. It's always scarier to be alone with a horror fantasy like Dracula playing in your head than it is to watch it in the safety of a crowded movie theater. The undead are easier to handle when they remain the unread.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein, research assistants from Penny Nelson. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Randy Newman comes to our studio and sits down at the piano for some music and conversation. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
They say that people living in the street, no food in the belly, no shoes on the feet, six black children living in a burned up room.